Dennis Holowinski, legendary vegetation management industry leader, joins us to talk about how he got his start in the industry. He talks about his challenges with liability and insurance in California, how he helped hundreds of utilities build their first veg management program, and more. Have a listen. Hope you enjoy. Well, welcome, Dennis. I really appreciate having you with us. I'm looking forward to talking to you. You know, so many out there listening today at one time worked with you, worked for you, or whatever. So I think our audience is going to really be excited to hear what you have to say.
Well, I'm glad to be here. Thanks for inviting me. I'm sitting here in sunny Florida just looking out at the beautiful weather, so I'm good.
I like it. So for those that don't know the name, I just say that, you know, almost everything we take for granted in the utility vegetation management industry, we can bring back to you, making it mainstay of the industry. You got it started, you laid the foundation, and it really a pretty cool story. So I hope you share that with us today. Yeah, tell us a little bit about your background and how you got started. And
well, my background is I'm a graduate of landscape architecture from the University of Wisconsin. We studied landscape architecture, regional planning, that kind of thing. I then went to work for the highway department in Dixon, Illinois for 2 years. After designing everything they needed to be designed, I was getting bored. I even designed a scenic overlook at the Quad Cities. And so that was after I got that done, they didn't have anything for me to do. So I looked for a job, and then I went out east. My brother was working for a company called Aspen Tree Company, so I went out east. They hired me, and they wanted me to run their environmental department. They had no idea what that was. All I know is their idea was, oh, we want you to landscape substations. I said, okay. Well, we never did much of that, but it was a great experience. And so I worked with them for, maybe 15 years. I then bought the company and started Environmental Consultants, Inc., and all of the rest is history.
So you started off landscaping substation, and I remember designing parks in Philly. How did you transition to the utility side?
Well, let's start from the beginning. First, we went to the highway department. They had me mowing grass. I know nothing about mowing grass or buying tractors or any of that stuff. Then, of course, we got to the doing a lot of design work for the city of Philadelphia. We did a lot of work for the bicentennial. We did parks, and we did the major parkways and all the squares and that kind of stuff. One of the, I don't know if you people know Bramble and Burns. They were really involved in a Penn State study, which was it's still ongoing for many, many years. And my person I reported to, Highland Johns, was in charge of that. Well, the ECIRCO, which was the, Empire State Electric Energy Corporation, they came out with a research study to look at the effectiveness of all their management techniques. And obviously, we had a relationship with Bramble and Burns. Highland wanted me to get involved, and I was happy to do it. So I put a team together, we put a proposal together, and we got the study. So we were involved in that for 6-8 years till we finished the project, because it kept on going. Very successful project. And so that's what got me into the utility business, quote, the utility business. And then it built from there.
Dennis, obviously, I've heard a lot of the stories through Phil's lens, right? You know, in terms of how you guys, where it started, just like you said, and then how you were able to build, you know, an incredible market position. What I'm fascinated by is, you know, at that time, given your background, you had some entrepreneurial juices to say, hey, I'm gonna buy this company from this large elephant, build something, and then sell it back to them, which I thought was pretty cool. So were you this like organically developed entrepreneur, or did you always have this personality and this skill set, or did you kind of learn on the fly?
I have five brothers and a sister, and I was in the middle. Everything was pretty competitive there in the farm. Let's say even in high school, all my brothers were sort of toed the line. They worked on the farm. They didn't do any type of athletics or anything like that. But I was always a black sheep in the family. I was always doing something they didn't want me to do. And so I went out for sports and I played all these things. And my dad wasn't happy with me. Actually, I would go to school, do sports, come home at 8 o'clock, and all the chores I had were left for me.
Oh,
so
boy.
I guess it started there, so almost every night I wouldn't get done till like 10 o'clock at night. So I guess somehow that built my idea that I wasn't going to toe the line, and I was sort of taking my own course. So I think probably that's the way it started, and I never...
A rebellious farm kid, huh?
Yeah, I guess you could say that. I think that's how it started.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. Okay. And at the time when you say you bought the company, what were you buying at that point? The naming rights, a little bit of reputation, a handful of clients? Like what was actually purchased?
Well, let's back up a little bit. I hope we get into the vegetate our line clearance programs, but that's in the background. That's already happening. So the reason I bought the company was we were doing these vegetation management programs for utilities. And when we started, we relied a lot on contractors, Asplund and other contractors, to give us information so we could be effective. By the time I was bought the company, we were all pretty smart, right, Phil? We knew all these things, and we were questioning what the contractor said, and we just didn't follow them anymore. We were doing our own thing. But we were going to utilities doing vegetation management programs. As a result of that, you have to present it to the brass. Most of those programs are presented to presidents, vice presidents of the companies, because maintenance was the biggest budget item in their budget. That's where they spent most of their money. So anyway, we had a program that could justify what they did and how much they spent, right? We in Connecticut, we did a study for one of the Connecticut utilities, and we had some people who are not too happy with that because they were starting to trim trees another way, which was the right way. And he wrote this article, actually put a full-page ad in the Audubon Society book that said, Asplund is scooping all the utilities, and they send out these guys to do their study, and then they get all this additional work, and it's just a scam. Well, that was just a ticket for me, because I was ready to get out then. So I told them I can't work under this situation, and my consultants don't want to work, and I'm just not going to do it. So eventually they sold me the company. So that's how I bought the company.
So Dennis, you talked about the research in New York. That would eventually be some of the most significant research behind integrated vegetation management that everybody strives to do.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, that's a transmission, but you got involved in the distribution side, if I recall, when you got a call from Minnesota. So how did you get into those programs?
One of the vice presidents of Asplund was trying to get to work at Minnesota Power and Light. And in order to do that, one day went in and said, oh, I'll tell you what your workload is. And they said, oh, great. So he went out there and he did this survey of some kind. I don't know how much. But he came to me with all these numbers that he had. And he said, Dennis, I got to put this in some kind of report. Will you help me? Well, I did. We put together what we knew, what we didn't know. We made some things up. And we submitted the report. It was probably about 10 pages, maybe 12. And that was in the early 70s or late 70s, early 80s. And they loved it. And I think I told you this before, Phil. Not long after that, I was up north doing some work on the circle, probably coming back with my wife, and I said to her, "This is a gold mine." I said, "Hell, this is worth millions of dollars because nobody has these kinds of programs." So that's how it all started.
Yeah. So when I left in 2006, we had done 160 programs. So a lot. So it was the idea of workload-based budgeting, which nobody had at that time.
In that time period, there were very few foresters in the industry, a handful maybe, and they were doing fairly good jobs. But most of the utilities put retired linemen or, linemen who couldn't work on lines anymore, they put them in charge of the line clearance programs. And every time it came to budgeting, they'd go to the contractors and say, "What do we need? What do we need? Come on." So the contractors would tell them what the system was like, and that's what they would turn in. Or they would say, "Oh, we just need 5% more." They had no clue. They really didn't know what was out there. So I realized that this could really turn out to be great. So we started, the whole process started with the fact he did a survey, and when they did a survey, they looked at trims and looked at removals and what types of trims, and that was it. And that's how we started. That's where you came in, Phil. We started, we weren't very good at it, and you came in and brought in statistics, which is what we really need, and then everything started to happen. Now, we didn't just look at whether it's trims or removals or what type of trims. We also decided that we needed to figure out species. We needed to know what was out there. So we did that. We knew the species. Suddenly then we figured out, well, we need to haul faster growing. So we developed a system to determine. We went out and actually took cuttings all over the place to see how fast the major trees, or the trees that grew the fastest, how long would it take for them to get into the lines given a certain clearance, right? So what we're trying to do is get a cycle of trimming. Okay, so once we figured out what types of trees they were, how fast they were growing, then we could say, okay, if we went every 3 years and we came back, we'd have X amount of trees in the lines, right? So now we had some data. So then we had to somehow sell it to utilities that how do you get your system into control? So we found out through a lot of process, basically with you guys, figuring all this out, but what we figured out is that if we spent X amount of dollars to get the system once over, totally trimmed, and then if we knew what the fastest trees were growing, we would put you on a cycle. So we would go to the utility and say, if you get over the system one time, it'll cost you, let's say, $15 million. But if you come back 3 years later, you could do that whole system for $7 million. And they'd say, why? And we'd say, because the fastest trees are the only ones that are in the lines now. The other ones haven't grown that much. So it was a perfect philosophy and formula because the utility top brass bought it. We would go to the PUC, Public Service Commission, and we would give them that same type of concept. If you invest it now, then later it would be much cheaper and you could maintain it at that cheaper level. So it was as we went along, it just was a perfect storm for us because it was really so easy to sell, and we were right. We were effective at it. So we developed something that everybody wanted.
40 or 50 years later, I think it's over 95% of the utilities are still on a cycle-based program that you recommended. So
yeah,
might finally be moving on, but that is the standard that was put out there.
Well, it was interesting, Phil, and you know this, is that when we went to utilities and regions of the country, the East, the South, the West, pretty soon we had a pretty good database of what trees were the major trees of concern and how fast they were growing. So we had this all over the country. So it was, as we kept going, it was easier and easier to sell. And it was effective with less and less work on our part. So it was a great program. And I think $1 million wasn't even close to what it was worth.
So Tej has, his company has several hundred contract utility arborists or line folks, different contract positions. You were the first one to sell that service. How'd that, I told people the other day, and I hope I got the company right.
Well, it was
Oklahoma Gas and Electric.
Oklahoma Gas and Electric. It was almost by default. At the same time, we were doing these design studies in Philadelphia. Oklahoma Gas and Electric came to us and said, we would like a forester, but there's no way we can get it in our budget. Would you guys consider giving us one, and we'll contract you for it? Well, that's like money in the bank. So I said, oh yeah, we can find somebody, absolutely. So we found somebody, went out and found somebody, and they loved him, and he worked there for like, I don't know, 5-6 years, worked at Oklahoma Gas and Electric, under their control, under their supervision, under their liability. It was just such a great, great situation. Detroit Edison was trying to get away from the contractors doing the notification of the property owners, and we bid on the contract. I remember to this day, I bid on it a week before Christmas, and it came in the day before Christmas, and they wanted the people out right after New Year's. Spent all my Christmas trying to find foresters. I had to get 12 foresters out there in a week. But that was the start. In that situation, we were responsible for them, and we were getting the notification permissioning, and it was a contract. But soon it was catching on that people just thought, you guys can provide foresters for a lot less than we can provide them for. So they started contracting us to put them on their system, and they would, again, supervise them, tell them what to do and how to do it. And it turned out at one time, I don't know how many people we had out there. I know at one time we were 350, 400 foresters out in the industry. We were one of the largest employers in the country. But here's the exciting part, Tej. What happened was every time a utility had a guy and they loved them, they would say, Dennis, we want to hire him. And I'd say, oh, yeah, sure, you can have him. Yeah, yeah, you can hire him, no problem. There's no problem here. How many people did we have working for utilities, Phil, that were now system foresters?
Yeah, probably hundreds. It's amazing that the industry grew off of those people.
Yeah.
Talk about a business model. It was actually fun because sometimes they would say, oh, we like this guy. Can you find us a few more? And I'd send the guys that were really good, that did a good job for us. And we didn't mind parting with them because in the end, it was just so good for us.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's how we started. We call it Foresters Unlimited. And and from a business perspective, this was really the key to our success, Tej, because doing the vegetation management programs, they were cyclical. We'd have them, and we'd be selling them, and they'd go up and down. But now we had these foresters, so this was our base. This was the base, basically, that paid our expenses. And then the vegetation management programs were, they say, gravy, Phil, is that what I could call it? But it was it was a place where we could do it quickly. I mean, I shouldn't say quick, but we could do it. And if we didn't have any of that work, we had the foresters.
Have you, Dennis, have you kept, I mean, I think you guys sold in the, I don't know, 06, 07, 08, somewhere in there?
Yeah, 2007.
2007. And so over the last, call it 15 to 17 years, I mean, obviously you're in Florida enjoying life, family time, but have you been tracking the industry? Have you ever looked back and said, hey, you know, I wish I would have kept it and maybe added different, you know, things to it, things I wanted to do, or were you happy to get out and have you never looked back?
Well, I got sick back, I don't know, probably 5 years before I sold it. And I said to Phil one day, I said, Phil, I can't work for the next 3 months. I want you to take over the company. You're going to be president and so forth. And of course, he agreed. And when I got better, I looked at everything and said, hell, he's doing as good or better job than me. Why should I get back into it? So I let him run the company with the people he had. He's very successful. Well, there are two reasons why I sold the company. One, I was already 55. But anyway, one was that we were doing work in the industry out in California, and fire suppression was a real issue. And we were getting to the point where we couldn't find insurance. We were last of it was at Lloyd's of London, and yep. They were questioning whether they wanted to insure us anymore. And so I either had to invest a lot of money and grow significantly or get out. Now, yep. That in itself wasn't the factor. The factor was there was so much liability in California that I mean, sooner or later, something big was going to happen, would put us out of business. I mean, that's the way I looked at it. And I can tell you that after I sold the company, there was a time when I said to my wife, can you live out of a trailer? Because I got sued for $86 million less than a year after I got out. And it was a claim that wasn't submitted till the day before the period for submitting it was out. and it was a mess. And it was, you know, the next year and a half, we fought it and fought it and fought it and fought it. Luckily, we had $30 million worth of insurance. Here's the key. The reason it was so high, Tesh, was because during that six-year period, the state of California said the Forest Service could charge for environmental damages. And they said they could do triple environmental damages. So a claim that would have been $15 million now was 80-some. So literally.
I see.
That's how it happened. So
yeah.
So when I was glad, when I got out, I said, this is glad I got out, because I said to my wife, dear, how much money can you spend? And she says, oh, I can spend a lot. Well, how much are you talking about?
Yeah. No,
there'd be a fire and we'd sit around the TV just wondering, are we in on this one? And don't miss those days, do you, Dennis?
No, and Tesh, it wasn't like, we didn't even have to be responsible. If we were anywhere near, if that was our lines, I mean, the lines could have fell down. It didn't matter because we were sued anyway. Yeah. So we were on every claim that we were the lines we were involved in. Right, Phil?
Yeah, it just was amazing. You get caught up, we'd be the first one on the hook. Haven't changed in that regard, but.
Yeah, it's definitely a complicated space. Liability insurance is still, those are themes today. You know,
you still have those issues, right?
Yeah. I would say, yeah, we have some issues. I think, though, the one thing, you know, I think there's been continued evolution in the utility space. And I think risk management practices, I think the utilities themselves have really net done a really good job of adopting stuff from the past, using technology. And you know, look, it's nature, so you're not always going to get it right. But I think for the most part, it's been very interesting for me to see, well, learn the history through Phil and through folks like yourself, and then see where the industry is and where it's going. It's fascinating, and it continues to evolve, is what I would say.
So I understand you have some retired lineman contractor now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, it's very interesting because Phil and I talked about that. That's probably how you got into it. But Phil and I talked about doing that years and years ago. But I don't know. We could never get that service going. I think we spent a couple of years trying to do it, but we never really got it going.
Yeah, you know, I give a lot of credit to, at least from we have a great team, right? We don't often talk about our people, you know, on this forum, but given that you brought it up, you know, I'll mention the fact that a lot of the people in our organization, they're so good. One of the things they're so good at is their bedside manner with clients, bedside manner with people in the field. And I think linemen are their own sort of breed,
yes,
entity,
yes, they
right?
are.
And they're very different than, you know, your traditional, let's say, vegetation management professional. So, you know, understanding those nuances and having people that can communicate, you know, with that group,
right,
is I think the key part that has allowed us to slowly evolve in that space as well. So, you know, I give credit to our people, that our leadership that's in the on the ground, you know, creating that stability, because essentially that's our whole position is centered around quality. You know, like, to simplify it for us, it's all about good work. If there's no path to doing high quality work, then we just kind of don't do it. We won't pursue it. If we don't see that we can actually execute something at a standard that is better than a previous standard that's been set, and we can't see a path to it, we generally won't pursue that.
Well, Phil, we had some similar philosophy. What was that our saying used to be? Do you remember?
Oh, you'll have to remind me, Dennis. But I remember quality was always the emphasis.
Yeah, I mean, if we did something wrong and the utility wasn't happy, we went back and redid it. I mean, we didn't fuss with it. We said, if you're going to do it, do what you say you're going to do, and do it right. And if not, let's do it again.
And
if you're going to be late, they better know it ahead of time. There are all kinds axioms you had.
We made up all kinds of things. Like, even in our studies, one of the things, Phil and I are famous for this. We don't know how this really started, but might have been over a cool beer somewhere. But we were trying to decide what is an acceptable amount of tree-caused outages on a system. So we knew a couple of foresters, a couple of companies that had fairly successful programs. The management was happy. And I think we sort of looked at those and we said, well, we think maybe 10% would be a good deal, 10% of outages, you know. And I think, I don't know which company we used it at, and we said, and I remember we were sweating it out because we said, oh, yeah, this will get you under 10% tree-caused outages. And it worked. And it worked.
Yeah.
And I think that's become a utility standard now, 10% of outages caused by trees. But it didn't get developed from hard data. It was more of a gut feeling. Right, Phil?
Yeah. And I do think there was a beer involved.
Yeah, we did. Well, you know, like, Tesh, you know this, because we were consultants. So people would say to us, have a project and say, can you do it? And, of course, Phil and I were very happy to say, oh, yeah, we can do that. Sure, we can figure it out. And we get down, we say, okay, how are we going to do this, Phil?
Yeah. I've seen that before.
But you can do anything, you just have to figure out how.
Yeah, Tesh, because if there's nobody else in the space, you're creating it. So it was challenging, but it was fun because there wasn't anybody out there that said we were crazy. Not many, anyway.
Dennis, do you have any interest, or have you, since you've been retired, you know, doing research or writing anything, or have you stayed at all kind of active with your kind of former body of work, or have you picked up some more social hobbies?
I would say that I haven't kept up with the industry very much. Most of it's been through Phil. I know I'm in touch with people. They call me, we talk, on the social aspect, yes, but I've picked up other challenges, if you will. I'm a golfer, so I do a lot of golfing. But one of the things I do, and I'm very proud of that, is I run two tournaments every year for prostate cancer research and also a vaccine for breast, ovarian, pancreatic cancer. And over the years, we've raised probably $750,000 toward that research through my golf tournaments.
And that's great.
Actually, I'm doing one next week, so they're always fun. They're always exciting. So I'm doing that kind of work.
Where do you host it?
Well, I host one in Pennsylvania, near North Philadelphia, and I host the other one here in Naples, Florida. And I get like 110 people, and they're always very generous. And because what you find out is, I didn't realize this, when I got prostate cancer, I thought I was the only guy in the world that had it. Well, I bring it up here and can run these tournaments. And I mean, there's so many people, so many guys that have had it or are struggling with it, and they just don't know where to turn. And that's really been my life after I retired. Let me put it this way. You got to ask yourself, what do you want this world of yours to look like? And then you got to ask yourself, what are you willing to do to achieve it? And that's my answer.
Yeah.
And of course, Phil's under the same deal, He's running this charity. He's educating kids in Belize. Can you tell him about your great program? Are you allowed to do that?
Of course.
Well, he knows as well. I mean, Dennis and Sue are supporters and actually are the ones that helped me get it started. So we do scholarships for kids in Belize. Right now, they get turned out when they're seventh grade. If they can't afford it, and a lot of them can't afford to go on to high school. So I think we're at about 150 scholarships a year. We had a group from the industry go down, and we did some plantings at schools to help cool them, help provide edibles and things like that. Have another group going in June from the industry.
We even built a church. We build churches.
That's right. I
think we have 35 people going in June. Including 7 or 8.
Everybody could use a little Jesus.
Yeah, there you go.
There you go.
Do you know that's a big deal now in the high schools and all over here? You see these little Jesuses sitting around with a little note that says everybody needs a little Jesus. See them?
Oh, wow, I did not know that.
I haven't seen those.
Oh yeah, they're all over.
Phil and I share a love for whiskey, so we've. On many travels, Phil has shared obviously lots about you and the impact that you've had, not just in the industry, but on other parts of the world. And certainly I've gotten very intimately familiar with Phil's philanthropic sort of impact as well, which is, of course, inspired myself. And, we have our own sort of education-focused commitment and things that we do for the local community here in Texas. So I love it. I love that, even within business and post, we can do this kind of stuff.
Doesn't it just do wonders for your heart when you can do things for people? I know Phil had that bug when he left. He wanted to become a minister. And I said, oh my God, Phil, are you going to be a minister? I said, how long do you have to study for that? He said, you can just go on the internet and you can get a license in about 3 minutes.
Yeah.
However, Phil built the church. Go ahead.
I did put a few years into the education.
Well, he went to Cincinnati and built this huge church. And And I think it's probably true, Tesh, and probably as you get older, the more it will happen, is that older you get, the more you want to give back. And if you're at all religious, you become more so.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you're working hard all your life and you just want to, there's a lot of people who need your help.
No doubt. At this stage of my life, I'm trying to integrate it as part of my life. And, you know, raising a young family, obviously helping lead some of the things that we're doing, obviously very fortunate to have Phil alongside me and us, you know, as we try to figure out how to continue to build on what you essentially started.
Congratulations to you for finding Phil, because he's one of the best guys in the industry, and good reason why we were successful. So
no doubt.
And then
I appreciate that, Dennis.
My biggest challenge is making sure Phil, you know, doesn't go towards any other hobby at this stage too much. I'm like, Phil, come on, hang out a little bit more.
I give you credit for picking that up. Phil was telling me your stories, and I'm saying, how the heck is he doing that? I mean, we couldn't pull that off, and here he's doing it. And Phil said, don't ask me, but he's pretty good at it.
I have to tell you, Dennis, it's all the credit. I will give all the credit to our team. I just love the people we work with. Obviously, Phil has been a key part in helping us kind of architect and think about stuff, because it's very difficult. This is an industry. See, you at least had some context when you started this entrepreneurial journey, right?
You're right.
A landscape architect. You saw something. If you're coming in blind, you're very reliant on the expertise, but being surrounded by the likes of Phil and Steve and Tom and then Adam and all the people, it helps.
How did you get locked in or keyed into the utility industry? That's what I want to know.
Great question. And this I give, you know, so much credit to my business partner, our CEO, my dear friend, Craig Taylor. Craig has this incredible knack for starting and building companies. Like, I've never seen anything like it across industries, like whether it's a financial, you know, kind of energy type services type business or, real estate, or it doesn't matter, right? He's very good at putting the pieces together, seeing the market opportunity, laying a foundation. And, you know, this started way back when. It wasn't vegetation management where we just kind of dropped in. Craig, formerly a naval officer, you know, had, you know, a friend, you know, saw a small opportunity. This gentleman was operating in the space, and, you know, Craig can see something and then say, I'm going to build something around that idea. And like most of the companies we started, there was an organic starting point. You know, we dipped a toe turned into a foot, we were diving in. And then all of a sudden, once we're in something, you know, our heads are on swivels. Now we're paying attention. But we were very much like, hey, bite off something that you can manage, do it well, and keep building. And that path eventually had us land on vegetation management, let's say, as something.
Right.
And then similarly, we are now able to do other things with the utility because we've been so committed to doing good work, working with the right people, emphasis on quality. And so that's we kind of built on that. You know, we've never been in a rush. We're very patient. And again, I think that's where Phil, yourself, me, Craig, we share that quality philosophy. And we believe long-term that tends to win out. So we don't get distracted by the short-term waves of price and chasing things. We don't get distracted by
that.
So,
you sound like you have the same philosophy. Where quality was very important. When you work for utilities, if you do what you say you're going to do and it's a quality product, they stick with you. They don't go somewhere else. They'll stick with you. They're very loyal.
And they are.
They pay their bills.
They pay their bills.
Somebody said to me, somebody said to me once, well, what was your accounts receivable like? I said, well, I think there was once that we, over all those years, we never had
one
a problem.
One time, I think it was a $5,000 bill that the wrong person approved the contract, and they wouldn't back it. But.
And it was the only time in all those years. I got to tell you a cool story. You like this one.
Yeah.
Remember when PG&E went bankrupt back in the 80s or whatever it was? It said, well, 90s. Remember the 90s, first time they went bankrupt? Yeah. Okay, we were doing a lot of work for them. And when they went bankrupt, we had, I think they had $2.5 million of our work they didn't pay. So they kept coming. After a while, after a year, we got this company came to us and said, we'll pay you 85% on the dollar. And at that time, we said, well, let's not do it. I mean, we don't really need to do it. We can get through this. And then it was 90%. And then it was something else. And then finally, they got back on their feet and they paid us all our money back plus 4.5% interest. It was the best deal we ever did.
Oh, yeah.
That was,
that's fantastic.
That was at the time when the market went crashing down. Yeah, and we came out of that smelling like a rose.
We went through a very similar thing with the PG&E bankruptcy that was most recent in, I think, 19. And so similarly, like, you know, there's the sharks came out looking to buy 70 cents on the dollar, 75.
Yeah.
And fortunately, you know, Craig and I are surrounded by good mentors, and we consulted a bunch of people on how to navigate that. But similarly, like, you know, we kind of patiently waded through it and were able to recoup the dollars. But, you know, you mentioned something, and I want to touch on this one thing. I think vernacular is important, and I think it helps people think about how they should view a utility or how they should view a client. And we tend to think about the utility as a partner. Whether, like, obviously there's a dominant relationship, right? Like, the utility is the one saying, I'm going to provide dollars, you're going to provide service. But we've always tried to view the relationship with balance. And I think that helps, because instead of you pedestaling the relationship, you're in a position where you believe you have something to offer. And if everyone's operating with that mindset, you're not afraid to deliver news that people don't want to hear, because you're honestly approaching the work. And I think that is, when I was thinking about quality, I was like, I want to give Dennis a little bit more of a glimpse into, like, how we define that. And I think so much of it is in the mindset of how even a supervisor interacts at the executive level, how we interact at the accounting level, how we interact. So we've encouraged our people to view the relationship from the lens of partnership, not just, hey, like, we'll do whatever you ask us to do. That's just not a good business relationship. So we don't operate that way.
And I'm so glad to hear that, because that's the way we operated. Like, let's take the management programs. We did the study, and they would say, okay, back it up. And we'd say, yeah, we'll back it up. We're in this together. And they said, okay, we'll spend the money and show us that we can do this. And then they did it. Or they'd say, put your reputation on the line and go testify at the utility commission and see if you can get the money. And we'd do that, and we did. And we got through the whole cycle. And, I mean, the people that used it, Phil, have you ever heard of any of our clients that were unhappy? We were so, we were so proud of our clients that when we would send out information, we sent them a list of all our clients and say, you call any of these people and get their opinion of how we did. It was so fun doing that.
Oh, incredible. Yeah. Well, Dennis, this, you know, I could do this with you all day, because the stories, I'm sure, I'm going to try to pull out of you. So I definitely want to encourage you to do a part two with us where we can tell some more stories. But this was fantastic. I love golf. My game does not reflect my love. So maybe one day we can tee it up, or I can come attend one of your
maybe
events.
I can give you an advanced warning. You can come and play with our group.
There you go.
My charity. I'd love to have you come.
There you go. I'd love to.
Because you're probably doing a lot of work here in Florida, right?
I am. Yep. I'm down there all the time. So
there you go.
On both West and East Coast. So let's talk about that offline, and let's see if we can get another podcast schedule with you where we can get some more stories, because I love hearing the history of this business, and you are obviously a very important part of the history. So thank you so much for
thank you.
This thing in motion.
Phil and I have a lot of stories we're sort of not telling you yet.
Oh, yeah. Well,
some we may not tell.
Part two. Yeah, let's part two.
Well, so, thank
Dennis,
you.
Thanks. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for putting me on. And I like talking about the past. And I really appreciate learning more about your company, because I can see why Phil likes to work for you, because you basically have the same philosophy we did. And
at that,
you're going to continue to be very successful. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And again, thank you for today. Fantastic.
Appreciate it, Dennis. Thank you.
That's it for this episode of Trees and Lines, brought to you by Iapetus Holdings. If you like the show, please give us a 5-star rating on Apple or Spotify. If you have any questions or comments on any of our episodes or ideas for topics or guests, we'd love to hear from you. Please contact us at treesandlines@iapetusllc.com. We'll chat with you soon.